Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, March 22nd, 2018. Facebook is under siege, and founder Mark Zuckerberg broke his silence last night with not just one, two, or three, but four exclusive interviews. Now, last time I checked, only one of those could actually be exclusive, but, you know, who cares? So, currently, we know that Facebook is being hammered from almost every direction because of the revelations that Cambridge Analytica was enabled to share massive amounts of data on as many as 50 million American Facebook users, and that it was used in the Trump campaign's targeting in 2016. And in a moment, I'll share with you that the Trump campaign was not the first to receive this kind of data. But Mark Zuckerberg has known about this for years. And given the arc of the interest in Facebook around so-called Russian meddling, around the minuscule paid advertising that came from the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg attempting to sway American voters with bizarre postings, Mark Zuckerberg should have anticipated this. He should have gotten out ahead of it, in front of it, and proposed some regime of regulation that he might think is reasonable and that addresses some of these concerns. But I believe that by delaying, Zuckerberg is going to face the imposition of regulations on Facebook. And I'll wait to see what those are. Some of them may be sensible and good. I've got some ideas proposed in an op-ed that I'll mention here in just a moment. And Zuckerberg was appropriately apologetic. But what does that mean? Because the fundamentals, the business model of Facebook, is that you create this center where people come and divulge information about themselves that can be used by Facebook to target ads and make it an advertiser medium that has generated huge profits for Facebook. And so Zuckerberg says, well, when asked about meddling in the 2016 election, I think that it's really hard to me to have a full assessment of that. There are so many different forces at play. Now, that's a non-answer, if you ask me, and maybe it's sincere on his part. But Zuckerberg really seems to be unprepared in many respects to address this huge crisis for his company. Now, he has said that Facebook is prepared to implement controls to ensure transparency in advertising. But listen to this quote. Now that companies increasingly over the next 5 to 10 years, as AI tools, artificial intelligence tools, get better and better, will be able to proactively determine what might be offensive content or violate some rules, and what therefore is the responsibility and legal responsibility of companies to do that. That, I think, is probably one of the most interesting intellectual and social debates around how you regulate this. What did he just say? When asked if he will appear before Congress, he said the short answer is, I'm happy to if it's the right thing to do. Then he went on to say, we just want to make sure that we send whoever is best informed to do that. Well, I don't think he can escape the siren call from members of Congress and sending Sheryl Sandberg to lean in, or, you know, an attorney or board member or anybody else, is simply not going to satisfy them. Now, Zuckerberg also said in an interview with the New York Times, we have a responsibility to protect your data, addressing Facebook users, and if we can't, then we don't deserve to serve you. Well, that sounds pretty magnanimous. But when asked, if people are leaving Facebook in droves, he said something to the effect of, well, that's not good. Let's see. Also in the Times interview, are there other Cambridge Analyticas out there? Were there apps which could have gotten access to more information and potentially sold it without us knowing or done something that violated people's trust? We also need to make sure we get that under control. Now, at this stage, if I were his crisis PR advisor, I would be saying, Zuck, look, these kind of comments are not going to help you. Going out there and asking questions in response to the questions that you're asked, those aren't answers. And that is not going to help your cause. So here's a statement that Zuck made in a post on Facebook yesterday. This was a breach of trust between Kogan, that's the professor who handed off data to Cambridge. This is a breach of trust between Kogan, Cambridge Analytica, and Facebook. But it was also a breach of trust between Facebook and the people who share their data with us and expect us to protect it. Well, the model is that we share data, not intentionally with Facebook, we're sharing it with our friends. And they get to watch. They're the voyeurs. They collect our data, and then they sell it. And they don't give us a return on those profits. Now, maybe shareholders can say that, but the users of Facebook are really the used at Facebook. So this is going to be a long and drawn-out crisis for Facebook. And it is encouraging that Zuckerberg has decided that he can no longer just avoid the publicity that is being generated here. He needs to get involved if he's going to have any hope of shaping it. So over at The Guardian today, Barry Lynn from the Open Markets Institute and Matt Stoller of the Open Markets Institute, and I've heard of Stoller before. I've read some commentaries from Barry Lynn before. It's not the same Barry Lynn who used to be the head of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. So these guys talk about what has created the near monopoly that Facebook enjoys. In 2017, Facebook accounted for 26 of external traffic referral to the websites of news publishers. And when you add Google to that, they really have what is called a bottleneck by these guys. They control 70% of the traffic. And independent media outlets like yours truly, Consortium News, World Socialist Website, we have seen our traffic decline because we are being filtered out by the fake news algorithms that have been put in place. They go on to say that Facebook exploits the bottleneck to divert billions in advertising revenues away from trustworthy sources of news and into its own coffers. So at the expense of the New York Times and other mainstream publications, Facebook grabbed about $40 billion of online and mobile advertising last year. So this does lead you to believe that it is more or less a monopoly. And one of the other issues is that Facebook buys out competitors. They bought up Instagram and then WhatsApp, and this gives them continuing dominance of these social media outlets and platforms. So these guys now offer 9 different ideas for regulation, and I'll just check them off for you here quickly. Impose strict privacy rules on Facebook, perhaps using Europe's new general data protection regulation as a guide. Spin off Facebook's ad network. I think that would be good to generate competition. Reverse the approvals for Facebook purchases of WhatsApp and Instagram and reestablish them as competing social networks. Prohibit all future acquisitions by Facebook for at least 5 years. That's pretty extreme. Establish a system to ensure the transparency of all political communications on Facebook. Require Facebook to adopt open and transparent standards similar to conditions that the FTC imposed on AOL Messenger in the AOL-Time Warner merger settlement in 2001. Establish whether Facebook violated the 2011 FTC, Federal Trade Commission, consent decree. Threaten to bring further legal action against Facebook unless top executives immediately agree to work with the FTC to restructure the company. And finally, establish whether top executives enabled, encouraged, or oversaw violations of the 2011 consent decree, and if so, pursue personal fines against them. Those are reasonable, rational approaches, and I think that we will see members of Congress pick up on these, and this will lead to significant changes at Facebook, and some that will be imposed without their input or influence. And we have to go to the Daily Mail, the British tabloid, to get this admission. A former media director at Obama for America said that Facebook allowed them to mine millions of people's information. This goes back to the 2012 campaign. They were on our side. Obama campaign director reveals Facebook allowed them to mine American users' profiles because they were supportive of Democrats. She said Facebook was surprised at the ease with which the Obama campaign was able to suck out the whole social graph. Facebook never tried to stop them when they realized what they were achieving, even told them they'd made a special exception for them. They were very candid. They allowed us to do things they wouldn't have allowed someone else to do because they were on our side. Now, this points up a number of important considerations, because I believe that the dark targeting that really helped the Trump campaign reach closeted racists and other people likely to support the comb-over guy, I believe that the $80 million that was spent on Facebook by the Trump campaign caused Facebook to say, well, we did it for Obama, now we'll be fair and we'll do it for a Republican. And we have to note that the Clinton campaign declined to have Facebook representatives work directly in the campaign headquarters the way they did for Trump. And so I'm not trying to rationalize any of this or to minimize it. But we have to understand that this has been going on for some time. Our data is all out there and commercialized. It's available for purchase, sometimes by nefarious actors. And I am not optimistic that we're going to get a handle on this and establish policies and protocols and legal remedies to protect people's privacy and to give us control over the data that is then exploited by Facebook, Google, and these other companies. Meanwhile, this has created the atmosphere where the Senate gave final approval yesterday to legislation that is aimed at stopping sex trafficking. But it is based on a crackdown on the website Backpage, where a lot of hookers and other sex workers were advertising and were told that 70% of sex trafficking advertising was occurring on Backpage. But the change that this law will put into effect is that the platforms like Backpage or Facebook can now be held accountable for illegal actions made by individuals who use those platforms. And this is an open-ended can of worms that will expand the liability of these websites that use user-generated content. And I believe it will have a stifling, not just a chilling effect, but a stifling effect on the personal expression, which is at the center of the appeal of Facebook and similar social media platforms. So only two senators voted against this, Rand Paul and Oregon's Democrat Ron Wyden. Wyden had written the bill that limits the liability of these platforms for posting user content. And I think this is a serious, serious mistake. Now, also, the Senate is getting active, and they interviewed the latest Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, yesterday. And they grilled her about what they say are efforts by Russia that are already underway to meddle in the 2018 midterm elections. Now, nobody ever says what kind of meddling this is. Is the troll farm in St. Petersburg cranking out information about congressional candidates or their challengers? Do they really drill down to that level of granularity in their efforts to interfere in the U.S. so-called democratic process? And what is the responsibility of Americans? We're all hunkering down. We're victims of this withering attack from these dark, dark forces that we always attribute to Russia. What about the dark forces in the United States? What about the haters who populate Facebook and Twitter every day? And aren't Americans now sufficiently wary of online information so that they won't get sucked into claims that the Pope endorsed Donald Trump or the Pizzagate stuff about Hillary Clinton? And they're throwing money at the problem. The State Department has a budget that we're told they haven't spent a dime from. They've got $120 million at the State Department to combat election meddling. How? What are they going to do with that money? Pay Russians to stay off the internet? Then there's money being thrown at the FBI, $300 or $400 million. And nobody tells us, you know, what the threats are that they are addressing and how Americans should deal with all this. It is just batshit lunacy. Speaking of which, the House has passed a $1.3 trillion spending bill, a mystery package of 2,232 pages, and we know that it's impossible that any member has read the entire bill. Maybe they carved it up and had 10 staff members each do a couple of hundred pages. But this is the sloppy way that our government is being run. And in this massive omnibus bill, we don't really know what's in there. There are pet projects for the right wing. There are pet projects for the left wing. And there's a whole lot of bad shit in there. We'll find out after it passes. And to compound all this, it is all funded by debt. We are borrowing virtually the entire $1.3 trillion. That is exacerbated by the tax cuts that were rammed through. And so we went from this kind of fiscal conservatism that was imposed on Barack Obama by the Republican majorities, and now they're just spending in ways that would make a drunken sailor feel inadequate. And so the Republicans say, oh gosh, in order to get the defense spending that we needed, we had to mollify the Democrats with a lot of crap that we never would have passed. But this is the ugly way that our government functions. And as the clock ticks to another phony deadline for a government shutdown Friday at midnight, we have the prospect that Rand Paul will once again use his prerogative as a senator to block consideration and force the government into this technical shutdown mode. And Rand Paul has his points. But this whole process of brinksmanship has really spun way out of control. And to see the Democrats enable huge increases in defense spending without any real mission for that money, and to cough up a nominal less than $2 billion for border security with restrictions that won't allow the kind of wall that Trump has talked about to be funded. So it's a big old mess, and we will watch and see if there is a technical shutdown occurring after midnight on Friday. Every day I take a moment to thank people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Susan Lundgren, Andrew Harnack, George Reeves, and Jason Ferguson. I'm grateful to those people. I have to tell you and share this with you frankly. Over the last few days, I've had three more cancellations and no new signups. And I'm not really sure what's going on, if people have just gotten tired of me because I'm so skeptical and annoying, or if people are having financial problems that cause them to cut back their spending. But it really is urgent that you, and I'm talking to you, you've been listening, you got some money in the bank, and you value what I do. So please express that by going to peterbcollins.com, click on menu, then click on become a subscriber. You'll land on the sign up page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or our $50 annual subscription. And I really appreciate your support, particularly at this time. So last week we were told that Trump was going to crack down on China and other steel exporters who were hammering the American market. And today, he announced details of the tariffs that he's planning to impose. And the amount of the figure targeted at China has doubled from $30 billion to $60 billion. And the White House has granted a long list of exemptions to American allies from the steel and aluminum tariffs that go into effect tomorrow. The exempted include the European Union, South Korea, Brazil, Canada, and Mexico. And what this clarifies is that China is the real target. And get this, the $60 billion figure is not aimed only at the steel export market. The tariffs will target 1,300 lines of Chinese goods, everything from shoes and clothing to electronics. This will cause a trade war, and we are going to pay, because the Chinese have mastered capitalism and know how to use it against the old guard here in the U.S. of A. And because we are desperate for their cheaper goods, whether it's sneakers or jeans or electronic toys made by Apple, China has the upper hand here. And Trump has launched this trade war in a way that is going to harm the United States, I think, in a major way. And I will restate for you that I am not opposed to an intelligent form of trade restriction. I'm not opposed to tariffs on principle. I am opposed to the arbitrary way that Trump is doing this and the likely fallout and blowback that we will pay for. Well, Trump's lead counsel for the Bob Mueller investigation, John Dowd, has exited the team. He resigned from his position at the White House today. And while he sucked it up in public, "I love the president, I wish him the best of luck, I think he has a really good case," his friends who leaked to the New York Times said that he's tired of having Trump ignore his advice. And Trump's recent public attacks on Bob Mueller, which we know that Dowd had counseled against, I think are part of the picture. Also, Trump reiterated today that he wants to sit for an interview with Bob Mueller, and as a defense lawyer, John Dowd knows that that is suicidal and that Trump is the worst kind of witness. He will no doubt get caught lying to the special counsel if he gives such an interview, and that perjury will pile up with the obstruction of justice and other elements of corruption that really make the whole Russiagate thing seem almost irrelevant. So the Times reports that the president is said to be pleased with Dowd's resignation. He'd grown frustrated with him, particularly over the weekend when Dowd called on the Justice Department to end the special counsel investigation. Now, that seemed like the bizarre kind of errand that Trump assigned to Sean Spicer on day one when Sean had to go out there and say that Trump had the biggest crowds in history at his inauguration. And so I thought that Dowd was doing Trump's bidding, but he had to walk back saying that he had not actually been speaking for the president when he made that demand that the special counsel just shut down because they asked for it. And we also are hearing rumors that Ty Cobb, the guy with a handlebar mustache and the famous name, may also be leaving the White House legal team. Over at the Justice Department, Jefferson Beauregard, Jim Crow Sessions III, has just learned that last year, after he was beaten up in his testimony before the Senate by former Senator Al Franken, because Franken was convinced that Sessions had lied about his contacts with Russians during the campaign and the transition. And what Sessions has learned is that Andy McCabe, who Sessions got even with by firing him and denying him a pension hours before his retirement was supposed to take effect last weekend, well, we have learned that Andy McCabe launched an investigation into whether or not Sessions had committed perjury. And we're told that McCabe enabled this process and that the investigation adds a new layer to McCabe's firing. McCabe's lawyers have said he did not lie, acted quickly to fix any inaccuracies or misunderstandings related to the Sessions testimony. And get this, Bob Mueller interviewed Sessions earlier this year as part of the investigation, and Mueller's office recently told a lawyer for Sessions that he could publicly say that the attorney general is not under investigation and was considered a witness, not a target in the case. Now, it's hard to, this is all based on leaks, by the way, and we're told that Bob Mueller doesn't allow leaks, it never happens. But the next story I have for you is based on fresh leaks from the Mueller investigation. Remember when Jim Comey publicly said that Hillary wasn't any longer under investigation? And then, after Trump was inaugurated, he beat up Comey to try to get him to publicly state that Trump wasn't under investigation? Well, for Mueller to let Sessions off the hook at this stage of an incomplete investigation just seems more bizarre. I can't explain it. So here's the next story. You probably recently heard about this guy, George Nader, a political advisor to the ruler of the United Arab Emirates, and his tag team buddy, Elliot Broidy, who's the deputy finance chairman of the Republican National Committee. And Broidy and Nader reportedly, and this is based on leaks of documents from the special counsel's office, hundreds of pages of their correspondence, it reveals an active effort to cultivate Trump on behalf of the Saudi Arabian monarchy and the monarchy in the United Arab Emirates. Nader tried to get Broidy. He dangled the prospect of more than a $1 billion contract for Broidy's private security company with the United Arab Emirates. He helped deliver deals worth more than $200 million with the UAE. He was on a plane flying into Washington when then he was going to transfer to a flight to Florida so Nader could attend the Trump one-year anniversary of his inauguration at Mar-a-Lago that essentially got curtailed because of a government shutdown that weekend. But the documents, according to the New York Times, contain evidence not previously reported that Nader also held himself out as an intermediary for Saudi Arabia's crown prince, that's MBS, Mohammed bin Salman. So this adds another layer of corruption, of scam artists operating inside the Trump administration and trying to seek and buy influence in the White House. And the beat goes on. At The Intercept today, a fascinating report, Byline, Ryan Grimm, Alex Emmons, Clayton Swisher, noting that Jared Kushner lost his security clearance, and the speculation is that it may be in part due to secret American intelligence that he revealed to that same Saudi prince, MBS. Now, Mohammed bin Salman took power last June by ousting the crown prince at the time, Mohammed bin Nayef. And Kushner, who is described as a regular reader of the president's daily brief from the CIA, he picked up names of members of the Saudi royal family who were opposed to the ascension of MBS. In late October, Kushner made an unannounced trip to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, catching some intelligence officials off guard. And our crown prince and Saudis were said to have stayed up until 4 a.m. on several nights, swapping stories, planning strategy. Now, the speculation is that Kushner named Saudis known to be disloyal to the crown prince based on his access to American intelligence. And then just a week after their late-night partying, Kushner returned to Washington. The crown prince cracked down on members of the Saudi royal family. You know, he locked them up at the Ritz in Riyadh. And we're told that at least some of the people named in the president's daily brief were among those rounded up, and at least one was reportedly tortured. Then we go into the crackdown led by Saudi Arabia on its Gulf neighbor, Qatar. That, of course, was after Qatar twice declined requests from the Kushner family to provide hundreds of millions of dollars in loans to bail out their troubled property in New York. And we know that some of the former members, like Rex Tillerson and current National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, have been frustrated by the freelancing of Jared Kushner. And based on his apparent misuse of intelligence information, that could be a criminal act that could send Jared Kushner to the slammer. And speaking of the slammer, it's sad to see that the State of Israel has sentenced both the teenage protester Ahed Tamimi and her mother to separate sentences of 8 months in jail, and they have been detained since December. Now, you know that Ahed Tamimi was videotaped by her mom as she challenged two Israeli soldiers who were standing on their property. And this was after an incident where one of her cousins reportedly had been beaten by an Israeli soldier. And Ahed Tamimi on the video is seen at one point slapping the Israeli soldier. Now, I saw the whole video, and there was contact by the Israeli soldier with Ahed before that slap. Nevertheless, the Israeli court has sentenced both mother and the teenage daughter to 8 months in prison. And at The Intercept, they note that here's a case. Thursday, another young woman, Yasmin Abu Srur from Bethlehem, was sentenced to 7 months in jail for a Facebook post. We also note that the Israeli soldier who was captured on videotape killing in cold blood a wounded Palestinian suspect in 2016. That soldier's name is Elor Azaria. He only got 9 months for killing the Palestinian. So, 8 months for slapping an Israeli soldier, but an Israeli soldier gets only 9 months for killing a Palestinian suspect who was no threat to anyone. The governor of Mississippi, Phil Bryant, has defied a last-minute appeal from the Trump White House and announced that he is appointing Cindy Hyde-Smith, Mississippi's agriculture commissioner, to fill the seat that's being vacated by the ailing and aging Senator Thad Cochran. And Bryant says this was his decision. Hyde-Smith said, "I feel the power of prayer and that armor of protection on me because we're going to be having some rough days ahead." Now, Hyde-Smith is a former Democratic state senator. She flipped to the Republican Party 8 years ago, and they consider her a very weak candidate. And based on their loss in Alabama, they seem to want to get Bryant to appoint himself to the post, but he apparently didn't have an appetite to go to Washington. Finally today, I follow the daily writings of an Australian journalist named Caitlin Johnstone. And today I'm linking to her most recent post, which really is a very helpful one for American leaders. It is a 6-point plan entitled How to Get Rid of Paranoid Conspiracy Theorists. She opens with this kind of seduction. "Are you as sick and tired as I am of all those tinfoil hat-wearing conspiracy nutters who express skepticism whenever the kind and beneficent U.S. intelligence agency bestow us with urgent information about a new country in need of regime change? Do you want to get rid of that kooky fringe 74% of Americans who believe in a deep state which controls the elected government? Well, you're in luck, bucko. I happen to have compiled right here a list of 6 simple steps that our compassionate government and fearless media can take to rid America of these Looney Tune paranoid conspiracy theorists once and for all. Now cover your ears if strong language and F-bombs offend you. Her number one proposal, stop fucking lying all the time. Simple, right? Just stop lying and people will stop wondering how the narrative they're being spoon-fed by their politicians in the media differs from reality. Number two, try some actual fucking government transparency. Sorry. That's right. Add government transparency into the mix, and what will hostile non-state intelligence operatives like Julian Assange have to publish? I say we drive the WikiLeaks fake news complex right out of business by eliminating the immense veil of secrecy which shrouds so many levels of the U.S. government. Number three, stop fucking killing people. Of course, it's hard to be transparent when you're conducting countless military operations all over the planet at any given moment, so we'll probably have to stop that too. Number four, stop promoting fucking conspiracy theories. I don't like to be a Debbie Downer, says John Stone, but when we've got news stories coming out every few days promoting theories about the U.S. president conspiring with the Russian government, it gets a little difficult to tell people not to indulge in conspiracy theories. Unproven claims about powerful people conspiring together is the exact thing that a conspiracy theory is. And while I understand that these are authorized conspiracy theories, we can't rely on these crazy loons to understand the distinction. Number 5. Stop being such fucking assholes. If U.S. intelligence agencies weren't torturing people, they wouldn't have to lie about torturing. If they weren't surveilling U.S. citizens, they wouldn't have to lie about it. If U.S. intelligence agencies weren't constantly committing horrific atrocities to protect the interests of the powerful from the powerless, everyone would trust them, and you'd stop seeing all these ridiculous conspiracy theories about what those agencies have been up to. And last but not least, number 6, maybe try some fucking democracy for once. People are beginning to notice that no matter who they vote for, they get the same exploitative neoliberal policies at home and the same murderous neoconservative policies abroad, which doesn't do much to dispel those wacky notions about a permanent unelected government pulling the strings while the official elected government puts on a pretend democracy show every few years. I've linked to Caitlin Johnstone's fucking essay so that you can read it for yourself. And this podcast is widely available. It's free. We put it on YouTube, where I hope you'll click on subscribe.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.